went to my doctor yesterday. She said I seem to be okay. She said, Paul, you better look around. How long you think that you can run that body down? How many nights you think that you can do what you've been?
Not fooling yourself. How's everybody? Hey, Traumedy Podcast. How's everyone doing? It's Ken Allen bringing you another exciting episode. This can be fantastic. Today I have on Joelle Melitis, who is a psychologist of military personnel and paramilitary personnel, specifically police and fire. And it's a really important interview because we deal with what happens when you're dealing with long-term and short-term stress brought on by the job and translated or bled back into the family unit. How does one in this profession handle this kind of stress on a daily basis? We love it. We get involved. We're action-seeking individuals. But all of that starts to build up in the mind and in the cortisol and on all of your steroids in the body. And sooner or later, it takes hold. And how the hell are we supposed to handle this stuff? Well, think about that chopper going overhead. Somebody in there is probably living big, feeling like they're on top of something. Maybe they're going on a call right now to go pick up somebody who's been injured. And they love it. They love being in that chopper. They love getting up and, oh, they're getting dispatched. Leroy Jenkins! They're going on the call. And then when they get back, they have to think about all the things that they had to see and all of the treatments they had to do on someone. And maybe some of the things they screwed up on. And that stuff lingers in your head. And then you go home and you're supposed to act normal in front of your kids and family or girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever you got. And it can be difficult. You know, we all have our own ways of handling things. Some of us have different hobbies. Some of us have separate jobs that relieve stress. Some of us have care loved ones that we care for that we can actually speak with and get that stress out. But some things just don't go away that easily. And when that happens, maybe you need to try something new. Well, Joelle, being a psychologist, is one available outlet for you. Or any kind of mental therapy. Think of it like physical therapy. You're not going to go in there and have your entire world dismantled. You're going in there to get some additional advice on perhaps how to let your brain think about it and how to process it. And look, if everything else ain't working and you want to be proactive, try new things. Read a book about it. Go to somebody. Talk to someone. The best thing you can do is something proactive without the addition of self-medication with alcohol, or getting angry and lashing out. You know that sucks. What do? I play a little guitar, and then sometimes I think about smashing it against a wall. What else do? Well, I write, and I do this podcast. And this podcast is a huge catharsis for me, so that I can get something positive out of the negative, out of the stress that I have over the things in life that kick my ass up against the wall, and then expect me to stand up. And that's what I'm doing. I stand up with this podcast. And if I can make one iota of difference by having you see that there is an option for you anywhere you go, any way you want, find something that works for you. Don't keep trying the old routine because it doesn't always work. Let's see. You can find Joelle on her website, which is, and she said, it's okay if I give it to you, Joelle Melitis. SMFT, that's Joelle, J-O-E-L-L-E, M-A-L-E-T-I-S, MFT at gmail.com. She's willing to talk to you. to point you in the right direction. If you don't want psychological evals, or if you don't want to talk to somebody, she's got a ton of reference material for you. And she can point you in the right direction. Listen, just by going out and trying to fix yourself, or trying to get some shit off your head, it's better. You're going to be better. You're going to be better for it. What I would advise is find something positive to do with your negative stress. Because in the end, really, it doesn't matter. We only get a generation and two-thirds on this earth. And in the end, none of this shit matters. We're all raindrops on a windshield. All right? So the more you can find to be happy about, and the less you can minimize your stress, the better it's just going to be. And the more positive effects you're going to have on people. So that if you die and all you are is just good thoughts to other people, you're going to be more good thoughts than bad thoughts. And I care. No. So that's that. Remember, Traumedy Podcast, tell everybody about it. Pass it along. Have fun with it. Say, who the hell is this guy, Ken Allen? He's talking some major trash. And he's having fun with it. And if you're having fun, I'm having fun. And if you're having fun, your friends will have fun with it. We're on TraumatyPodcast.com, Stitcher Radio, iTunes. Find me. Check it out. Play it in the workplace. Have fun. Guys, if I can make a fool of myself for your benefit, so much the better for this world. And if you think I don't get stressed, why don't you listen to this? So many things in life cause stress factors, right? It could be all these things we're dealing with. You know what does it for me? I think the number one stress for most people on earth is traffic. It's a daily torture we put ourselves through. Think about this little ditty. This is even after I've had all of my amazing Europe revelations. Here's me traveling from San Jose to San Francisco between jobs.
Well, how you doing all out there? It's Ken Allen. Guess what? I'm sitting in the middle of traffic commuting from San Jose to San Francisco trying to get to my second job as a teacher. And you won't believe this, but I've been stopped in just regular commuting traffic for about an hour and 15 minutes. I've literally not touched the accelerator for the last 7 minutes. And so now I'm really trying to get into that Zen mode that I keep talking about. And just let it all roll off my back like a water off a duck. Guess what? I'm getting a little angry because this is crazy. I'm trying to do a job to save lives, and all I can do is sit here and listen to people talk on their cell phones, they're doing their nails, and guess what? There isn't even an accident up above. I've checked Google. I looked on the CHP website. This is just regular commuting at 10:30 in the morning. This is, what is going on? What are we gonna do about this? Now my mind is reeling and I'm trying to figure out, at what point is this gonna change? Because there is no plans to set up a second freeway getting here. We already have the 101. You know how shitbagged that thing is. That's like, oh, it's molasses in a tree in January. It ain't going nowhere. Now, I have to do the scenic route to 280, and that's usually the easy way to get here. But apparently, the powers that be, oh, what's this up here? They decided to do some construction on it, because I see some arrows up above, and now they've shut down the last three lanes, just so our commuting people trying to do their daily jobs at work in the city have to filter into two lanes of traffic. It makes perfect sense. Let's do your construction in the middle of the commute hours on one of the major freeways getting into our great city. Oh my God! Oh, yeah! On a lighter note, it's going to be a great day today because I'm supposed to be teaching some fun scenarios and I'm really jazzed about that. So maybe what I'll do will be a head decapitation of a Caltrans worker who is holding a shovel and directing people to the right. That's going to be my first scenario. Oh, here they are, boys. Oh, I'm sorry. Am I in your lane? Let me see if I can get one extra buffer lane zone over so I don't scare you. Oh, my God. Let's try and take this energy, channel it. All good things come from impetus of negative and necessity. Go positive with it. Push it out there. I'm now being directed over by some divine intervention. Oh, no. Into a lane that apparently has a throughway. Of course, now as we're all being directed over, you get those fucking assholes who decide to go straight anyway and cut in front of what, three or four more cars, and then decide, oh, I'm just gonna scoot inside you. I'm not gonna even look over. I'm just gonna start veering into your lane and you're gonna have to stop. If I see this dude in the white probe, I'm gonna fucking veer him into the friggin' cow worker's car. Make his little probe the fender of the friggin' aero truck, yes! And then I'll drive by going, oh, what? Oh, I didn't see it. Oh, I'm sorry, did I get in the way? I didn't see it. Okay, no, they've shut down three lanes and we're all being directed out of one lane. I'm through. Should I say something mean? Should I be a dick? Because here they all are. Okay. There's nothing on the freeway. There's trash. There's nothing going on. And I'm through. Hey, welcome to another episode of the Traumedy Podcast. I'm your host, Ken Allen. New age thinker, positive mind. And yes, it even happens sometimes. I get a little bit berative. And however, we all have to deal with our stress in our own way. And it's okay to feel the anger sometimes. Because you know what? You get it out. I feel an awful lot better. If you ever have to scream at me, give me a ring. Get on the email. This segment is brought to you by Caltrans. Caltrans. Need to get somewhere fast? Go wherever we aren't. Talk to you soon.
You see? So there are positive ways of dealing with stress and negative energy. Joelle, how do you feel about this? Without any further ado, I bring you Joelle Miletus.
Kid, you better look around. How long you think that you can run that body down? How many nights you think that you can do what you've been doing?
My brother was an Army Ranger.
Oh, okay.
And he was paratrooper before that.
Got
so
it.
He had about 46 or 50 jumps under his belt before. But then they just do the zip tie. They do the, or the zip line.
Got it.
Zip line?
Yeah, you jump
static, the static.
Static,
line.
Yeah.
Low altitude.
So they, yeah.
Got
so
it.
It's a little different. Got and he it. Almost, there was one time where he was jumping. You know, they just, one
yeah,
after
yeah,
another,
yeah.
one after another. He had gotten in the air of somebody below him. So his chute is closing, and he's standing on this person's parachute.
Oh, gosh.
And the thing that you have to do is you have to literally run across the chute. It's rock hard from the wind, so you can actually walk on it.
Wow.
And he ran across the chute and jumped off of that, and it caught. And he said, okay, so how far do I... And he slammed the ground. And he's like, I blacked out. Woke up maybe a minute later and thought, oh God, okay, can I move my legs? And he's like, I could feel my toes wiggling,
yeah.
feel my feet. And he's like, all right, I can get, and at this point they're like, let's go. You know, so no time to even think about it. I think I just destroyed my back or
right,
I could have
right,
died
yeah.
or anything else.
Yeah.
It's just moving to the next thing. I think I should probably front load you right now, right? So welcome back to Traumedy Podcast. It's Ken Allen. I'm sitting with me, Joelle. How do you say your last name? Miletus?
Yep.
Miletus. Joelle Rebell Miletus. She is a counselor specializing in training or working with military, paramilitary personnel. How are you, Joelle?
I'm good, thanks.
We've
How
been
are
talking.
You?
I'm great.
Good.
This is fun.
Good.
Beautiful
it is fun.
Office. Nice lighting.
Thank you.
Mood lighting. So, Joelle, why don't you tell the viewers, the listeners, about yourself, your training, how you got into this field specifically.
Oh my goodness. How did I get into the field? My first career, I was a ballerina by training, and had a very long dancing career and loved it. And then I started teaching university and loved that. And after several injuries and not wanting to lecture about Martha Graham, I thought psychology sounds good, and really threw a dart at a dartboard and went, all right, we'll go here and start then. And it worked itself out. There was really no preconceived notion to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I've just fell in love with it and have been doing it since 2008 and loving it ever since. So that's a little bit about how I found psychology. I have a master's in education, and I have a master's in fine arts dance, and then I have a master's degree in counseling psych, and almost done with my PhD. Not quite.
Wow.
But in counseling psych. So I work as a marriage and family therapist, and I'm licensed to work in the state of California. And I come from an eating disorder, addictions, and what we call co-occurring mental health, which means usually having an addiction with some kind of mental health issue, be it depression, bipolar, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first experience really working in this field, working in inpatient hospital, residential centers, and did a couple of fellowships very specifically working with addiction and very serious mental health issues, schizophrenia, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, I started working with a lot of trauma, but also realizing that eating disorder specifically was what I was interested in. Go figure, being a ballerina,
right.
You can, you know, connect the dots. Mm-hmm. But I think everybody goes to psych school to fix themselves, but that's my own opinion. But I started working with a lot of trauma, and it wasn't a coincidental connection. And a lot of PTSD, and that really put me in the realm of working with paramilitary and military, just because I had fantastic supervisors and was really moving more in that direction. And that's more of what my clinical research has been on. And then my PhD program has been a clinical-based program and really looking at trauma and PTSD. So that's primarily what I do. And then 85% of my private practice is either military or paramilitary.
85%.
Okay. Yeah, so most of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you said your clinical work that you're doing now, is it PTSD in the paramilitary, in your clients specifically, or are you getting information from people outside of your work?
Both. You know, yeah. It's there. Unfortunately, there are not a lot of classes in working with military or paramilitary. There is a new program for social workers at USC, working with military specifically. It's a 2-year degree program. And then there's a couple of other online that are APA accredited, but there's really nothing out there. There's about 12 books that talk about military, or just 2 or 3 about working with military. So,
right.
You know, it's one of those things where it's on-the-job training, which I think in a way is not great for being a therapist. You know, it's difficult to then, you know, stop somebody and say, okay, wait, I don't understand that acronym. You know, a lot of it is understanding the language, the culture, you know, and being comfortable working in that realm. And it was a good personality fit for me, I think, just the culture, and it made sense.
Mm-hmm. You grew up around it, right? Your father
I
was
did.
In the military?
My father went to military school from 4 to 18. And then, and actually was in a PhD program during Vietnam, but did intelligence stuff.
Mm-hmm.
His father, so my grandfather, had my father very late in life and was a tank driver in World War I.
Really?
You can believe that. Yeah.
I don't believe it.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
This is pathological. Okay.
Yeah.
Where was he in the...
So he was in Canada. He lied. He was 16.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And lied about his age. And, of course, he didn't need any documentation. And they shipped him over. And he drove tanks and gassed and sent home. Literally shipped. And then shipped back and drove tanks for a second tour and gassed and sent home. So he survived twice. And they said, you're done. And he was honorably discharged. Uh-huh. And he said, no, I'm not. And ran away to the U.S. and lied and said he was 18. And I was probably like 20 or 22. Uh-huh. And, you know,
yeah.
No, I'd never been in the service. And went and drove tanks again.
So, again, in World War One.
In World War One.
So, okay.
So that's my...
Did he get gassed this time?
He did.
So three times, he's got a hat trick on gas.
He had a hat trick on gas, survived them all, and he died at... 89, smoking a cigar and probably having a double Jack, you know, every day. So it's my grandfather, my dad's dad. And then my uncle, my father's brother-in-law, was a World War II vet in Normandy for the Army. It's in my family and then my mother's side too. So it, you know, right. I grew up really in this military-esque kind of family, and very much my father ran the household that way. And,
okay.
You know, would stand over us and make us refold towels and reload dishwashers and, you know.
So talking to people that grew up in that kind of background, or we say military background, what are the things that make it, you know, a military background versus a traditional household? What are the big things that you notice that are different?
That's a really good question.
That's why I do this.
That's why they pay you the big bucks.
That's why I'm getting paid exorbitant amounts of money for the podcast.
Exactly.
Right.
Because
it's a decent... That's the whole thing. It's, you know, finding people...
Go ahead. Yeah, no, no. So it was things like... like I said, you know, I mean... We had our chores, right? I have a younger sister, so we had our chores, you know, and go put the dishes in the dishwasher, and, you know, we would do that, and then my father would come in and say, no, they're not stacked right, and he would unstack them and then watch us restack them. And it took me until about 13 to finally, you know, scream at him, if you don't like it, you do it yourself. That did go over real well. Mm-hmm. But, so, you know, it was things like that, you know, structure and order. No, we didn't have to have, you know, hospital corners on our beds, but, so I think that that's, my experience isn't quite military, like the military brats, which is a very common term, and it's not degrading at all. You know, the kids that grow up and are on from deployment to deployment or base to base, where I think it is even more structure. You know, things get done at a certain time, beds are made. There's a level of expectation of structure and order that must be maintained, and a lot of it has to do with mom and or dad, whoever is in the military, coming home at the end of the day. They're coming from a very structured world, and there's no tolerance for unstructure, and they don't know how to function when there's not structure. We see it a lot when people are coming back from deployment, and they're first back, and they open up their closet, and they have, you know, 20 shirts, right? They have 20 t-shirts and 4 pairs of jeans and 3 pairs of shoes, and they're in their civvies. They don't have to wear fatigues, right? And then they're wearing the same green shirt for 3 weeks in a row. And then the wife has been out of shape, right? Change her shirt. And they're completely overwhelmed. There's no structure. There's no order. And so it even goes down to that lowest common denominator of, what do I wear?
Right.
So I didn't grow up in that kind of a house, but definitely the structure and order, there were high, very, very high expectations.
Okay.
You know, and so it was, I think in some ways that's different. There's not a lot of... there's not a lot of tolerance for sort of having your own identity and sort of this flowing self-expression, which is interesting because I was a dancer. So in that way, my dad was different.
But you were a very different kind of dancer. Your dancing was incredibly strict. I mean, there's no more structured, strict, disciplined dancing than ballet.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was babysitting, you know, it was the perfect structure for a structured, you know, both my parents work, so I got, you know, went to school and then got dropped off at the dance studio and came home and I did my homework and I went to bed. And yeah.
Right.
So it was very structured. It's perfect. I did that 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so I think it's important to have structure for sure all the way through. Do you notice that a lot of the people that you treat, that you talk with, Do the ones that had structure have more issues or more problems than the ones that were allowed to have a free life and be a free spirit? Do you notice any issues between the two, or which ones tend to come to you more?
Yet another good question, Ken. You know what? I haven't noticed a difference, but that's one to definitely put on the dissertation list for sure. I think that with boot camp And because of, you know, all six branches, they all run the same kind of enlisted program, right? Officers are a little different depending on which branch. Mm-hmm. But if you're going in as an enlisted kid and you're 17 or 18, right, mm-hmm. and you're going in, it's the same kind of boot camp. And so they completely break down whatever cultural basis that you're coming from, structured, military, unstructured, paramilitary, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Everything is completely broken down and it is redesigned, right, to meet the military's mission. And right now it's war, right?
Right.
You know, depending on what time of year it is, it could be, you know, peacetime mm-hmm. operations, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't necessarily think that their childhood experience necessarily predisposes them to have an easier time coming home or transitioning out of the military.
Right.
I definitely think there are personality types that I would say are more predisposed to transitioning or not transitioning. Mm-hmm. You know, some just don't. They like being in the military. They like the structure. It works for them. They're career military. You know, officers, it's a little bit of a different situation.
Right.
You know, they're coming in with, you know, college education and, mm-hmm. and to do other things and typically more administrative things.
Well, it seems like with boot camp, it really is, it's in essence the destruction of the ego.
You got it. Yeah.
When you go in as an officer, you're going in with that, I'm going to be leading these people. So you have a, you know, I need to have a different type of way of looking at this whole picture of the group and my position within it. I'm leading it. I am responsible for the decisions. It's not so much you're going in with an inflated or arrogant attitude, but a more sense of yourself within the whole.
Yeah.
Potentially.
You know, they call officers, you know, fork and knife school. It's like, mm-hmm, they don't do boot camp. They do, you know, a small little version of it. And, you know, so it's fork and knife school. And it is a, you know, there's cultures within cultures. So, mm-hmm. I mean, just, you know, take the Army. It's the largest branch of the service, mm-hmm. right? And you've got enlisted and you've got officers. So you've got two different cultures within the Army. And then within the enlisted culture and the officer's culture, you've got cultures within, right? Mm-hmm. Within cultures. And structure and hierarchy. And so it doesn't go over real well when you have, you know, a 10-year, you know,
sergeant
enlisted
or,
yeah, yeah, first sergeant who mm-hmm. has, you know, a 22-year-old college kid that hasn't been deployed yet who's
sure.
now his boss.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it's there is a big difference between boot camp and between officers and officer training. In my opinion, after working with both groups, I think since the war has been 13 and a half years at this point, it's supposed to end, you know, we're supposed to be sending troops back into, you know, 2014, but we're sending more troops over. And I have a lot of clients that deploy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what really does happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's going to be a big difference between officers and enlisted as far as deployment, how many deployments they've been on. If you've been on multiple deployments, you've been on multiple deployments, and you have similar experiences.
Mm-hmm. You've internalized it in your own way.
Exactly.
And you have the experience.
Yeah. So I think in the beginning, there's definitely differences. But mm-hmm. you're right. You know, it boot camp is getting rid of the self and integrating into the team or becoming, you know, part of a whole. Or Jung said the collective unconscious, right?
I love it. Yes. Forgetting so. Carl Jung. Okay. And we have very similar things in the fire department.
Absolutely.
It's not to the extreme that you're speaking about. But we just recently got a 28-year-old captain that showed up to our station, which is a pretty, pretty intense station. Everybody that works there has been in the department for 12, 15, 20, 25 years. And you get that same attitude from the engineer who's been saying, I've been here 17 years, and this 28-year-old kid's going to come in and now be the captain. That's not
right.
going to happen.
Right.
You know, it's just that kind of attitude, I think. And you know, when you're a probie, when you begin, you have to stand until someone tells you to sit. You don't watch mm-hmm. TV. You don't speak until spoken to. You're cleaning the bathrooms. You're cleaning up around the place. Mm-hmm. And it's all to get you into that mindset that, okay, you're here for everyone else to make sure that you're doing a good job, and then once you do that, then we can start to respect you, appreciate you, and let you do the job here.
Sure.
I think it's a good learning experience that it seems like, and I don't want to sound like, you know, old man Allen saying, you know, kids these days, but I grew up with the same kind of attitude where you had to get up in the morning, clean, do your chores, and that's what gave you an allowance to go buy what you want.
Right.
It doesn't seem like kids around, the people that are coming in right now, really understand that you basically work a lot more than you get credit for.
Right.
But you're not working for people to see it. It's more for you to be building some kind of character for yourself. What I'm getting back to thinking about was, if you've noticed people that have a harder time adjusting when they come back out or they have more stressful situations, have you noticed maybe that they grew up in a more liberal environment? They just weren't used to such regiment and discipline. Is that what's causing some of the PTSD? Or what exactly are some of the things that they're coming back with? Is it the issues with adjusting to a more casual atmosphere? Is it the initial shock of being so regimented? Or is it the things that they're seeing over there?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above, right? Mm-hmm. And to go back with what you were talking about at the fire station and how somebody, you know, earns their respect, right?
Right, right.
You know, or their street cred, so to speak.
Sure.
You know, it is the same. I think it's the same. And it's interesting with a lot of the firefighters that I've had an opportunity to work with, yeah. Each and every one of them had said, you know, if I don't do this, I don't know what I would do. They eat, breathe, and sleep it. And then their families come second. And it's not literally, but in their mind, who they are is their job, which makes sense. I think you and I had a conversation earlier, and I was saying, I remember retiring from ballet and retiring from dancing and thinking, I have no idea who I am. All I've done since I was three was do this. So now who do I get to be?
Yeah.
So I think it's that same, because of that indoctrination process, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's that same mentality. You break down the self and you work with the group, and your identity becomes the group.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's who you are. And if you love your job, or like you know, come from a long line of firefighters, right? It's very much who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's the same when you're looking at paramilitary and military. I don't know what makes one person adjust versus one person who comes back with serious trauma. I mean, I think trauma's in the eye of the beholder. And what I mean by that is, something can be extremely traumatic for me, and you look at the situation and say, "Ah, that's not trauma,"
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
So it's very subjective, and I think a good clinician, a good therapist, is one who can sit with that concept. Just because the therapist may not see it as traumatic, or the book doesn't say that it fits, quote, the trauma or PTSD requirements, but if it's traumatic for the person that you're sitting with, it's trauma, you know, and it should be taken very seriously. So that's the work. Mm-hmm. And why they come back the way they do, or why some have PTSD and some don't, there's no definitive answer. People are researching it all the time. You know, with the military, the suicide rate in the military causes more deaths than being killed in action. And most of the suicides that happen in the military, most of them never saw combat. So it's hard to know, right? Is it what they're seeing? Is it what they're experiencing? Is it when they come home, they don't have a support system here? And that's really what I think is, especially where we are, right? In the general Bay Area, there's not a lot of military bases. And so if you come back, you know, to San Jose, you come back to Berkeley, you come back to San Francisco, you're not coming home to a military base,
right?
That you may have been living on for 10 years, where it's a little city. It's mm-hmm. a city within it. It has its own grocery stores. It has its own shopping centers, its own McDonald's, Starbucks, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Bowling alley, you know, football field, little league, school, daycare. And some people never leave the base, right?
Right. And community of people,
exactly,
too.
And right. friends, and that become their family. So, you know, you leave that and you come, let's say, back to the, you know, San Francisco Bay Area, well, you're looking going, okay, who's military? Is there anybody? And it doesn't feel like there is.
Right.
Right? And you're all of a sudden alone. And if you don't have family, if, you know, people more that are single than married or divorced, there's a very high divorce rate in the military. You know, they don't have, there's always already a lot of trauma and drama, right? Mm-hmm. So they're coming back to situations that may not be ideal or conducive to support somebody who may have trauma. Mm-hmm. So my opinion, right, with very little research to support it, is it's more about the support system than it is necessarily what they see. And I think that that's the hardest adjustment in order, you know. It's the same thing for you as a firefighter and as an EMT, right? In order to do your job, there's an emotional component that you have to shut off. Otherwise, you can't do your job, mm-hmm. right? And I think it's the same thing for the armed forces, right? There's an emotional component that has to be turned off. My job, my mission is to get the enemy.
Right. Right, I have to kill somebody.
I have to kill, or several people, right? That's my mission. And in order for me to do that well, right? I can't be emotionally invested in that. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the piece that they come back and lament over, you know, unless it happens to be civilian or friendly fire. Again, there's some very traumatic
that's
situation,
the issue. Yeah.
Right? But doing their job, I don't think is the issue. They come back and they don't know how to translate that to their friends, family, their spouses. They don't want to tell people. It's the same thing coming off a fire, right, where people die.
Yes.
You don't necessarily want to come home and share that with your loved ones.
And you do, but you know it's not going to end well.
Right, and then they don't want you to go and do your job, and there's nothing but a battle, right? And then you've got strife at home, which ends up destroying relationships, right? Because you're fine with it, you just need to talk about it and get it out, and then you can check it and go, okay. And I know that sounds callous, and I don't mean it that way, but
that's exactly how it is. Yeah.
But there's a compartmentalization that has to happen in order for you to be successful, right? And
yes.
Yeah. So, and then the spouse or the, you know, girlfriend, boyfriend, parents sitting there listening, you know, are white knuckled at the table, saying, "You're not going tomorrow. There's no way you're going to your, you know."
Right. So, or why did you tell me? That's the other thing. Like you, and there is a compartmentalization that occurs.
Yes.
Most of the time, necessarily.
Yes.
But it has to be a temporary compartmentalization because you can't let that thing become an abscess that starts to fester and grow. And you do need to get it out, either through counseling or hopefully you can speak to your wife, husband, you know, family. Just is that going to be beneficial? And like speaking about the fire department right now, 65% of our department is either going through a divorce or has gone through a divorce. It's just, that's an average number across the boards between police, fire, EMS. Yeah. 65% of all marriages are ending in divorce.
Yeah.
So what I'm concerned with, see, growing up in my house, we were able to talk about everything. It was a unique situation. My father was a firefighter. Mother was a nurse. She worked in the ER, the ICU. And so that was dinner conversation. We'd sit around and talk about, you know, holy crap, you should have seen this guy got in a car accident or motorcycle accident. This guy just ran in. And he would go through these graphic, not so much graphic details, but he would phrase something in a sentence. And I'd just sit there and think about it. Wow. You know, his leg was so shattered, it was just wrapped around the entire bike. It just looked like a sack of leg.
Right.
And when you're 7, that's, you know, you think...
That's intense.
It's intense, but it didn't affect me.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It doesn't strike a chord like, didn't scare me. It was just a very visual image. Mm-hmm. And maybe because I was exposed to it at an early age, it never really became something that stuck. Mm-hmm. But getting back to my parents being able to talk like that with each other seemed like a really beneficial thing. I don't see many couples having that opportunity because of the difference of jobs. And it ends up being more so like, why are you telling me this stuff? I don't want to know this. I don't either want to know to affect my mindset, or I don't want to know that that's what you're going in and doing tomorrow.
Right.
So what do you do with it?
Yeah, and I mean, it's, you know, this whole notion of you know, having a battle buddy, right? Or I mean, you know, your brothers that you, you know, fight fires with, right? I mean, it's that same kind of mentality that becomes your family. That's who you talk with. And you're right, you know, I think the problem happens when the compartmentalization starts to take over and then you don't know how to switch from one to the other. It's like, oh yes, I have to have emotions now. It sounds so simple. Oh yeah, just, you know, I show up at my job at 0500 and no emotion, right? And I come home at, you know, whatever it is, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and the minute I walk in the door, the emotion, you know, clicks on, hi honey, I'm home. And it doesn't work that way. You know, there's some transition that has to happen. I think paramilitary and military, they're getting younger and younger. Every year they're getting married younger, they're having children younger. So I think a lot of it is there's not a skill set development. Mm. There's a lack of being able to hold conversations like that. I think that the marriages that are successful with paramilitary and military families are those where you have somebody who's in a similar type profession where they can talk about their careers, you know, and it's very common to see military and nurses or firefighters and, you know,
doctors and nurses,
because you can talk about that,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's difficult, right, to be able to
yes.
find somebody who can even stomach what you want to, you know,
what you need to say, yeah.
you know,
mm-hmm.
Like you said, you know, I don't want to hear about that,
mm-hmm.
you know, or I'm going to have nightmares now that you've told me, you know, that you were picking up somebody's body parts and having to put it on the stretcher as they're still living,
mm-hmm.
which yeah, I'm sure you've had to do and
yeah.
military's had to do. And, you know, the spouse mm-hmm. doesn't want to hear that.
No.
You
it's
know,
a, yeah, it's.
It's gruesome.
Jarring, yes.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's from what I'm kind of figuring out with like what a traumatic, emotionally traumatic event is. It's just something that is sensually, I don't
mm-hmm.
know, whatever, your sensors, all of your senses
mm-hmm.
are overwhelmed to the point that you cannot process. There's nothing to it. There's no funnel. There's no funneling that goes on. And so it's just this, you know, and floating ethereal thing that stays there that just keeps playing in your head. What is this? How do I make sense of this thing?
Right.
It doesn't fit the rules of how normal life is. It doesn't fit the rules. You said friendly fire issues, things
mm-hmm.
like that. Cause, you know, when people get in the military or even people in the, you'll hear in the mafia or something,
mm-hmm.
they'll say, well, we know the rules of this game.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you play by these rules, they're okay with it. They're okay with killing other people. They realize that they could be killed. But when it starts to become children involved in the event, when it's friendly fire killing their
mm-hmm.
bodies, that's against the rules. How does the mind deal with that?
And a lot of the PTSD issues are exactly that. It's, you know, a lot of times I'll ask infantry, you know, how many K do you have?
Mm-hmm.
And they laugh and they, I mean, with especially with the way that I present, and they laugh. They go, you don't want to know. Like, there's nothing, you know, that you're going to say I haven't heard,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I had one, you know, one young man say, well, my first tour, you know, it was 180. It's pretty high.
Ooh.
Okay. You know, we're talking infantry, so.
Right.
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 Does that bother you? Nope. So what are you having nightmares about? I'm having nightmares about the little boy who had an IED strapped, you know, to his chest, and my buddy went to pick him up. It, like you said, it doesn't make sense. It's
mm-hmm.
not by the rules. It's nothing that would happen here. It's not our culture. It's not military culture,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't use women and children.
No.
You know.
It's not by the Geneva Convention. That,
right.
Well, there are
and,
rules.
And when
all
I
put
say,
out.
You know, and I'm not talking about women in the military, right? But
no,
even
meaning
women in the military
civilians
have that
right.
same mentality. You know, you don't use women and children.
No.
So it's though, like you said, it's things that the brain cannot make sense of. I can't make sense of the fact that I'm the only one living out of 18 of us. And I came home, and not only did I come home, but, you know, I may have one prosthetic leg, or I may have some mild brain trauma, or I may have PTSD, right? I'm not a paraplegic in a wheelchair.
Right.
And my buddies that I've been overseas with, right, are gone.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, So that's, I think, the trauma. I don't think the trauma is the, quote, killing component of it, or actually even what they're seeing mm-hmm. with body parts and things like that. It's the same thing for somebody who's been doing, you know, fire or EMS, right? It's not the body parts after a while. That's not where it becomes traumatic. The trauma is, you know, a child that you have to explain to their parents and it makes no sense, yeah. right? And then you have to live with it. Right. You have to watch them grieve, and and they're looking to you to have an answer, and you don't have an answer. You don't know why, right?
Yeah.
And you're the first one they're dealing with, and that's what you get to go home with. Mm-hmm. So then how do you deal with it, right? Who do you talk to about it?
Who do they talk to about it?
You know.
Family sometimes is not going to be the case, it sounds like, by far and in large.
Hence the 65% divorce rate that you're talking about, right? Because after, you know, 10 years of coming home and talking about every SIDS call you've been on, I don't want to hear about it anymore, right?
Right.
It's like, can't you talk about anything? And that's what I hear when it, you know, with couples. It's like, they can't, you know, can't you talk about anything else? It's like, well, no.
No, this is affecting me.
Yeah.
You wanted to talk about emotional things.
And when I tried talking to you, you shut me down and you didn't want to hear it. And so, you know what? A bottle of Jack goes really well with my job, because a couple drinks after work and I don't have to talk to you. You don't have to hear me. We can function. I'm okay. You're okay. But that doesn't last either.
So let's get into that. That's the second half of it. You can talk to your spouse. You can always talk to Jack.
Right.
How often do you see,
alcohol
and drug abuse? Is that pretty rampant in armed forces, in fire department?
I would say more paramilitary, just because there's the drug screening is less often, right? Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, enlisted military, mm-hmm. it's pretty hard to get away with that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It is not hard to be drunk, though.
No, that's, well, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
But, you know, when you start talking about people that are reservists or veterans or, you know, I think then that falls into the same range as paramilitary. So I put that in with firefighters and police officers and, right? It's a lot. You know, I hear it a lot. And especially, again, with the younger, you know, the 20-something or early 30-something, they're newly married. Maybe they have a new baby at home. So there's all sorts of life stressors and adjustments. To begin with, forget the job. I mean, take the job out of it. You know, you're not sleeping. You got a new baby. You have a new wife. Whatever the case may be, right?
Sure.
So there's all of that to contend with. And then the stress of the job. And, you know, you've got a new baby at home. You go on a SIDS call and you're freaked out. And you don't want to tell your wife because you don't want her to be freaked out. And, what you know, it's like, I'm just going to have a drink. And that I'm just going to have a drink goes into I'm going to be drinking every night. Mm-hmm. And then that's another cause for divorce, right? So I see a lot of it with, you know, with the addiction. And I think there's a difference between being an addict and being dependent, right?
So really? So go into that. I don't know the difference.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a clinical difference. And dependency is one who cannot function without having whatever substance. So, you know, you can be addicted to Afrin and Kleenex, right? If you're dependent on having your Afrin and your Kleenex and you need that every day or you can't get out of bed, mm-hmm. not only is it an addiction, but it's a dependency. Right, you can be an addict to a substance, and then when you get clean and sober, you no longer have a desire to use. Hence, you're not dependent on it.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So I think the alcohol and drugs for many become a crutch. It becomes a dependency. They're not necessarily, they don't necessarily have addictive personalities.
Oh, okay.
But that dependency becomes an addiction. Does that make sense?
Yes.
In some ways.
Yes. But if they didn't have that or a stressor, they wouldn't be going towards addictive behaviors or chemicals.
Exactly.
Do you notice that there are a lot of addictive personalities in healthcare or in military? I mean, I know.
In psychology, yes. I had a teacher once who I absolutely adored, taught diagnosis, and at the end of a year-long class, which is an awful lot of diagnostic classes, she said, well, here's the deal, you know, to be a really good therapist or psychologist, you have to be an even better codependent. And that still cracks me up.
That's great.
But if you think about it, part of what we do, you know, the three of us in this room, right, is taking care of people, We do that all day long. Mm-hmm. We take care of people. And if we're not taking care of people out on the street or in my office, or, you know, you're taking care of the people at home, or you're taking care of the people in the station or your office, right? So in some ways, that analogy makes a lot of sense. We're always taking care of people, and we don't take care of ourselves.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So...
it's scary. Yeah. It's a very scary situation you get into. And, I mean, we identify by helping other people.
Absolutely.
So if we're not doing that, what are we?
Right. You used the word ego very early on in the podcast, right? And in a sense, is it narcissism? I don't think so. I mean, maybe. But, you know, some of it is that ego boost, right? Hey, they got help, or... you know, hey, they're now seeing a therapist, or their marriage was saved, or, you know, they came out of this building and they've got some injuries, but they're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. They're living, right? Mm-hmm. There is a satisfaction with doing your job. We get a lot of self-gratification in what we do, and that in itself is an adrenaline rush, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely.
It's not just running into the burning building that's an adrenaline rush. It's being able to help people. So you're right. When we're not helping, which is usually on the weekends, mm-hmm. right? Or on our off days, what do? Right?
Very true.
Sleep, work out, you know, okay, cause that can be another addiction, right? Working out. But sleep, work out, watch TV. If we have families, deal with our families. If
deal.
We don't, drink. You like the word deal?
Yeah.
And that's exactly my point, right?
Uh-huh.
Because
sure.
we deal with our families, but right. we help everybody else.
Uh-huh. Right. Scary. No,
we don't help our families.
What is it about this profession? We're talking about addictions, and I mean, the big word you hear is adrenaline junkies.
Mm-hmm.
It's why we get into this field. And, you know, people always say, what do you run into burning buildings for? Well, they don't actually follow it through. Well, I'm not just running into a building to be there. I'm running and hopefully somebody's going to be there I can pull out. I'll be able to stop this side of the fire better than anybody else that's out there. And it's like, if I can do this really effectively, I'm going to be important to the world.
Mm-hmm.
But why am I running? Why? What is it about this group of people that decides that that's what they're going to do? And if so, why is everybody else doing anything other than this? For me, this is where it's at.
That's the ethos, right? That's who we are, right? It's, and again, it goes back to, what are you at the end of the day if you're not fighting fires? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, what are you at the end of the day if you're not dancing? You know?
How was that for you, by the way?
I don't know.
Just that crisis, that situation, when you went through that, what'd you learn?
I went to psych school so I could fix myself.
yeah.
You think I'm kidding?
No,
so
I hear you.
I mean, hell, yeah. You know what? If I never do anything else with these degrees, you know, I've had a hell of a lot of personal therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's got to be worth something.
Right. A little pricey.
A little pricey, but you know what? It was worth
it's
it.
Worth it. It's
worth it. 8 years of my own therapy.
You took a me decade.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness. Then I lost the question. No. I have no idea, right? It's, how was it for me? I still struggle with it. You know, I still, and you notice in this interview, I keep going back to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, wait, we're talking about psychology. I forgot.
Mm-hmm. It's still a huge part of
it's,
you.
It's, yeah, you know, so, I mean, there's that, you know, sort of, you know, Freudian slip, bahaha kind of stuff, is I keep going back to, well, I understand this because of what I went through.
Sure, right.
Right? Not as a psychologist or a therapist, right? So it's a huge crisis. I think it's a huge shift, because it's who you are, it's what you love, right? It's what you eat and breathe and sleep. And, you know, why doesn't everybody do it? Because everybody doesn't find value in it.
Mm-hmm.
They have value in other things.
Other things, right.
Right? You know, building the next game, which is not, is it a noble profession? I don't know. I think that's subjective, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know what? If they love doing it, right? I mean, if, you know, it was Paine, right? Thomas Paine. If you want to sit and count blades of grass, so be it. Who is it affecting?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think it's that ultimate, you're asking this philosophical question, like, who are we? Why do we do this? Well, it's our ethos. It's who we are, right? Mm-hmm. Help people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If we're not helping people, then what are we doing? Because there, for whatever reason, there's a contribution.
Right.
There's a communal or worldly contribution that is important to us. And whether we get that from our families or we get that from our own ideals, that's what, you know, I think that's what people that are in the helping professions, that's what puts us there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And maybe we have a big enough ego to think we can. I don't
mm-hmm.
know.
Of course we do. And to see that you're doing it well is the other half of it. I mean, there are two coins to your profession. It's, I love to do this. Am I good at it?
Right.
And you really hope you are. And if you're not, you find different avenues to go down to maybe make it work. Or, I mean, at some point, it's just like, I've exhausted everything. But does it ever go away? And should somebody let it go away? I'm just speaking for myself. I love playing music.
Mm-hmm.
I did it through college and through my 20s. I used to tour. I used to play. And then I just kind of weaned myself off of it. Kind of like, it's not going anywhere. I'm 27. 25, it's just, I should be someplace else now. And so I just stopped playing as regularly as I did. It hasn't gone away. I still write music every single day. I still play. But it's almost kind of a goading, painful thing to go back to.
Mm-hmm.
But I still identify with it. In fact, I was telling my buddy Devin here today, I can interview better for fire gigs. I can go into fires. I can speak to the class better because I used to play when I was 18, 19, 20 years old in bars and clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And I got over that and I learned how to use that energy to something positive.
Right.
So it's the life experience is really what pushes you now. I mean, getting into this profession, it's great to help people. Are you actually doing it well? I think that whole pride of hoping you're doing it, you know, or doing it well is what's giving you self-importance in the military, that you get rid of your personal ego, and now I'm working for my platoon,
mm-hmm.
my group of people. And I've heard several times, I'm not afraid of dying. I'm afraid I'm going to let these guys down.
Yep. Exactly. But I hear that from police officers and firefighters too.
Yeah.
You know? It's what's going to happen to my buddy.
Yeah.
If I screw up.
Well, that concludes part one of our two-part segment with Joel Melitus. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Remember, you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and www.traumatypodcast.com. It's a great day today. It's August. The sun is shining. My buddy Devo's over here watching an episode of Jeopardy. We're about to go hit the city for a little music festival. So what the hell? What can you complain about? Life is up and down. It goes up and down and around. All good things. I want to leave you with this little quote from Ray Bradbury, whom I love very much. Fantastic author. And changed my life. One of the first people to do that. Talking about Dandelion Wine. In that book, he makes up this fictitious town called Greentown, Illinois, where it's bucolic, sunny, magical. One of his critics said to him, "You grew up in Waukegan, where it's shipyards, coal yards, railroad yards, and it's an ugly, gray-slated, smoggy hulk of a town. Why don't you ever write about a town like that, where it's you talk about the ugliness of it?" And Ray Bradbury said, "Beauty and ugliness don't exist for a boy. Children don't understand beauty and ugly. They just know the truth and the real. And I'm writing about the real to find the truth." He says, in other words, if your boy is a poet, horse manure can only mean flowers to him, which is, of course, what horse manure has always been about. So out there, everyone, take your shit and turn it into fertilizer. I'm Ken Allen. Remember, if you got it, then use it. Peace. We dug in deep and shined.